Hey, everybody, welcome to this week's episode of the OIG Roundtable. I'm sitting in a room with very bright lights. I just realized that you could actually see the lights and they shine. The good news is that shows that I'm clean and freshly showered for this week's episode. Of course, Matt and Wade don't suffer the same affliction of having an inordinately high testosterone level. That's really what it comes down to. So these are the problems that I suffer on a daily basis. No commentary, Matt, because I know it's coming. So we're just going to let it go. So thanks for joining us today.
I've been watching the ads with Doug Flutie and the baseball player, and going to go for that yet.
Yeah, the Nugenics. I need the Nugenics. Yeah. That's what I need. Yeah,
well, she'll like it too.
That is true. So this week's episode, we're going to talk. I got a great article, and Matt and Wade, thanks of course for always being here. And Wade, we missed you. We did the OIG TV table because you weren't here for the round table. So there was an amazing press release out the other day on OIG investigation. OIG and FBI got together. South Florida case involving a really unbelievable drug diversion case out of South Florida, in which a wholesaler was diverting drugs, purchasing the drugs, black market, repackaging the drugs in some cases, or putting the wrong drugs into bottles. And then those drugs were then going into the marketplace to pharmacies, unsuspecting of what was going on. And the drugs involved HIV drugs that patients were not getting. And we saw in one instance, at least, a patient who needed an HIV drug was given Seroquel, which is an anti-psychotic drug, which caused them to have a reaction that brought them to unconsciousness for a 24-hour period. Just mind-boggling. And I want to share real briefly for everyone. The drugs were coming into the marketplace through the pharmacy. So the case is owners and CEO of a wholesale pharmaceutical, $92 million. This fraud scheme went on from August of 20 to September of 21. So we're talking about 1 year. So that's a lot of drugs. HIV drugs, very expensive, as everybody knows, in the Medicaid, Medicare, and in the commercial space. But essentially what was going on was they were taking these HIV drugs. These bottles were in the garbage. Bottles were previously opened and just being refilled. They were coming in Ziploc bags and things of that sort. I mean, just really unconscionable. This kind of resonates back to, for those that have been, that are involved in the space, that remember the case back in Detroit from a number of years ago, Dr. Fareed Fada, the doctor that was giving chemotherapy drugs to patients that didn't have cancer. Those were legitimate drugs he was giving, but you know, the collateral argument I'm making here is, you know, you're giving drugs to people that don't have a particular affliction. You know, people that have HIV need these drugs to live. And we know that when these drugs are taken and they're properly taken, they have a very, very high effective rate for making people not be symptomatic and being able to potentially transmit HIV to unsuspecting people. So, you know, to see that this was going on and to see that people that have HIV weren't able to get it. And the fraud scheme was pretty straightforward in the traditional sense that they were just recruiting people, selling their bottles of drugs, selling the scripts, paying people for them, and then repackaging the drugs, shipping them in. You know, in one instance, we saw that a rep was shipping them in dirty old diaper boxes from the trash, picking out bottles from the trash and then shipping these. The crazy part is that this was a legitimate wholesaler. While it may not have been one of the big ones that everybody knows in the industry, it was a wholesaler nonetheless. And so Wade, for a period of time, you did pharmacy investigations on the medic contract for a bit. And, you know, one of the things that is pretty prevalent in pharmacy fraud investigations in any way, shape, or form is inventory reconciliation. It's kind of a standard practice in pharmacy investigations. There's a number of steps that PBMs take, the medic takes, SIUs take in doing investigations. And one of those pieces of the puzzle is inventory reconciliation, which is simply looking at the drugs that were purportedly dispensed and matching up the drugs that were purportedly dispensed to the inventory that the wholesalers are producing. And you do a match and you say, you billed us for 100 of this. The inventory from the wholesaler says this. This is a little unique because the pharmacies weren't part of the fraud, right? It was the wholesaler duping the pharmacies to an extent. And inventory reconciliations may not actually get you what you need. So this is a challenge for an SIU investigator, but talk a little bit about, you know, how that whole process works, right? And the importance of doing an inventory reconciliation, regardless of what the ultimate scheme might be.
Yeah, that's like a typical, you know, method or a typical tool that an SIU or a IMEDIC investigation would involve. And it, again, like you said, it's a inventory reconciliation where you're looking at the drugs from the manufacturer standpoint and kind of tracing the process goes from a manufacturer to a wholesaler, from the wholesaler to a pharmacist or a pharmacy. But in this case, as you said, it's not the typical investigative process because of the diversion at the wholesaler level. So it's typically, you know, those processes or the inventory control kind of gets you, you know, from point A to point B, manufacturer to the pharmacy, and then to the member. But right, because they were diverting at the wholesaler level, which is kind of unique. The other thing that was interesting about this is that there was some reporting as far as the compliance situation that was set up. There was a reporting up the chain of command in their compliance, but it kind of fell on deaf ears. So it's kind of another red flag that process should have, you know, if it fell on deaf ears, that the typical compliance is set up so you can go directly to, you know, the CEO or whoever. It shouldn't be right, stopping with a compliance officer. So this is another case where the compliance program just simply didn't work. They should have been able to go around where it was falling on deaf ears. The fact that this was attempted to be reported and fell on deaf ears is, you know, problematic.
Yeah, you know, a little bit for me, what I was a little surprised at is when you look at the pictures that they put in the press release, you normally don't see photographs and things of that sort in the press release. But what was relatively amazing to me was the condition of the bottles, the medication bottles. Now, they were dirty, the labels were messed up, they had the safety seals were broken. You know, and a lot of people know that when you are on certain medications or you get certain medications, oftentimes what the pharmacy does, if let's say, for example, the person's supposed to take one pill a day for 30 days and the bottle has 30 pills in it, oftentimes all the pharmacy is doing is affixing the label to the existing bottle, right? They're not repackaging the bottle. They're not dispensing 30 pills from a massive bottle. They're just moving it along. And so it's a little shocking when you look at the quality of the condition of these bottles to see, like, you know, the fact that nobody raised the stink. But, you know, part of this is also in this space is that in the pharmaceutical space, there's a lot of discussions involving pedigree. We see this a lot with diabetic testing supplies, for example, that there's a part of that supply chain is that only authorized wholesalers that are approved through the manufacturer and part of this wholesaler supply chain organization get approved to produce the medication or diabetic test strips, for example, through authorized wholesalers. And so it would have been an interesting thing. And I think, you know, the problem, I think, from an SIU perspective is your relationship as an SIU investigator is with only those that you're contracted with. So in this space, the manufacturers aren't contracted with the PBMs. The wholesalers aren't contracted with the PBMs, which is why for those that don't know this, when you're doing a pharmacy-related investigation, the SIU investigator can't make a request for the invoices from the wholesaler to the wholesaler. You have to get those requests through the pharmacy, where you say to the pharmacy, please have your wholesaler send us these invoices. Well, the problem is that the fox is watching the hen house, because oftentimes what you see is the wholesalers, if they're in some sort of a nefarious relationship, the wholesalers will send copies of the invoices to the pharmacy first and say, hey, what do you guys think? I mean, I know when I was an OIG agent, I did a lot of pharmacy cases, and I would see when we do search warrants, you see the emails where you see the communication between the wholesaler and the pharmacy on this. But this is one of those things where if you think that there is a patient harm issue, this is an issue in which the supply chain was clearly broken, right? The normal supply chain was broken. This is one of those where if I'm an investigator working on this case from an SIU perspective, I would be reaching out to the manufacturer and saying to the manufacturer, hey, look, I know we don't have a relationship, but we think that there's a problem with the supply chain with your drug. Please help us on this. And you know, maybe you're getting law enforcement involved sooner than later, but you know, this was pretty audacious. There was a real patient harm related issue here, particularly when you're dealing, HIV drugs are life and death drugs. We're not talking about deciding whether you're going to get a flu shot or not a flu shot, right? People that aren't getting this drug put their entire, become entirely immunocompromised. I couldn't believe when I read this press release, it was just so disgusting to see that the level of greed of, you know, where this was over a year period, it was just mind-boggling to me. And so, you know, it makes you wonder, like, what novel approaches can you take from an investigative perspective? And so, Matt, you know, the thing that always comes to mind is if people don't understand how to do a pharmacy investigation, that's going to present some great challenges because they're not even going to know where to start. But this is one of those situations where you get this case, you know, for us here at Advise, we're doing investigations that are across the gambit, right? We're doing some work involving pharmacy. We may not be doing pharmacy fraud investigations, but having that data works into that, right? You need to have that data because having that data is going to tell you, number one, this is a patient who has HIV because their diagnosis is going to be HIV, their endocrinology, they're going to HIV specialists, but also what pharmacies are they going to? Is there a common thread in these pharmacies? And what information can you glean from the data for investigators to feel comfortable with understanding what their limitations may or may not be?
Correct. Yeah, and you have to follow the data. And in something like this, the data is not going to look out of line, right? Because there's no question that the patients that were getting the drugs needed the drugs. That wasn't raised, at least in the press release. They were supposed to be getting these drugs, probably getting them in the right quantities. The invoices that were created by the wholesaler and sent to the pharmacy, according to the press release, some of them falsified, some of them ginned up, would have passed muster had SIU investigators looked at them or done this inventory, you know, review. It would have passed. So where this thing falls to is the failure of the pharmacies, whether they were involved or not, or just were so enamored with whatever prices this wholesaler was giving them for the drugs that they overlooked some of the quality problems and didn't even think about the actual source of the drugs being, you know, diversion products.
Right. But this was,
it would be very difficult to investigate this.
This is mind-boggling to me in one way, Matt, is that you're the pharmacist or the, what they call the pick, pharmacist in charge, the manager, whatever it may be. My guess, and this is just my guess, because this was a smaller, what appears to be probably a regional wholesaler, they are probably supplying more mom and pop pharmacies than they are the big box chains. The big box chains are going to the large distributors, the large wholesalers. Maybe they have their own wholesaler or distributor. So I have to think this is segmented small wholesaler, mom and pop pharmacies. But at the end of the day, it is mind boggling to me when you look at the pictures of these bottles and the fact that nobody said on day one to the wholesale, hey, what the F is going on here? You said these are dirty bottles. The seal, which, by the way, a lot of people may not know this, the creation of the seal was the result.
Tylenol.
Matt, of what?
Tylenol.
100% right? The safety seal was the result of the Tylenol issue back in the 80s. For those of you that aren't old enough to know this, there were some issues involving Tylenol and Tylenol being tainted with cyanide and causing some death to people. And they
unsolved to this day.
They don't know. They thought there was an insider person. But anyway, the point I'm making is you don't have to have strong investigative skills. This doesn't pass the stink test. You get a bottle that's dirty. You get a bottle where the seal is broken, like all of these things. So it then lends you, so okay, you now see this common thread of the pharmacies. Very difficult to investigate these things, but this may be one of those instances where field level investigators, and again, like we have these teams of people that are doing this, where you send out a field level investigator to go and talk to some of the people at these pharmacies because the pharmacies are clearly not happy about this, right? You could see that there was testimony from the pharmacies. They were complaining about it and whatever it may be. But it also kind of begs the question of you get a bottle and the bottle is dirty, the box is dirty, it's a diaper box that it shipped in. Like that should raise a stink. But also as a pharmacist who's dispensing this medication, there's, you know, you become familiar with what the medication looks like. Now, we're not talking about a drug that has a generic equivalent, in which oftentimes those drugs look exactly the same, and there's no way to know, is this the name brand? Is this the generic, right? You know, so there's a fraud scheme called generic substitution, where the pharmacy bills for the name brand of the drug, they put the generic version in the bottle, and they're profiting the additional spread, right? If the name brand paid a dollar and the name brand cost them 80 cents, this profit is 20 cents. But if you bill the name brand at a dollar and the generic costs you 30 cents, you're selling the spread. And so this may not have been the case, but even if it was the case, the pharmacist has to make sure, is the drug I'm dispensing the right drug? Am I going to have an interaction? But this may also be one of those instances where once you've identified that this may be the issue or the problem, sending out your properly trained surveillance investigators to go out and do this, who are conversant in these issues, are going to be in a place where you can maybe get some of that extra information that you need to move on.
And maybe speaking to members as well, because I'm sure they were unhappy with the condition of the drugs that they were getting from the pharmacy, especially if they're going to their doctor and their viral loads are, you know, going up because they're not getting the right drug or it's expired or whatever it may be. And, you know, and that only not only puts them at risk, it puts everybody, their partners at risk as well. So this.
Yeah, I mean it's super important. It's you know, if you're a diabetic and you don't take your insulin, and your A1C levels climb, right? This is the same situation. If you're not taking your HIV meds properly, your viral loads will climb, and you're going to go from being asymptomatic or not transmittable of the disease to these collateral things. I will tell you, I thought 38 years, at first blush, I thought 38 years was not an appropriate. I think it was combined 38 years or something. But
Something
when
like
I
that.
saw that, and I thought, you know, that's not really a lot of time considering that, you know, these people were essentially playing Russian roulette with people's lives. So the question is, you know, like what's going on here? I mean, they went to trial, which is kind of an amazing thing to me, considering that the evidence appears to be pretty, you know, pretty straightforward. You know, with the press release specifically talks about 28,000 bottles of black market drugs, and it looks like they got the 21, I'm looking at the press release now, $21,850,000 in restitution, which means 92 million was billed and they got that, you know, nearly 30 million over the course of a year. HIV drugs are very expensive. So, and I can tell you from working on cases involving HIV, and these are high dollar drugs. And the big schemes that you typically see on high dollar drugs are short pilling, meaning supposed to put, if it's one a day for 30 days, instead of putting 30 pills in the bottle, they put 28 pills in the bottle. And most of the time, by day number 28, the person says, oh, maybe I took two that day, or I had some problem where I took too much. So people don't think about it. Or the generic substitution, when there is a generic on the market. And unfortunately, because the generic pills oftentimes look the same. I mean, my personal opinion is that the generic pill should look inordinately different than the name brand pill. They should not look the same. Because that you have no way of knowing if the pills look the same. But the ability to look empirically at, you know, at a bottle and say this isn't the right bottle should really just raise a flag from day one. Because at the end of the day, the pharmacist becomes the last line of defense with patient harm. Similarly, CPC, CPMA auditors or coders in a medical practice are the last line of defense for stopping fraud.
And you think 28,000 bottles, the source of which was black market drug diversion. That, think about that. There's these hordes of patients getting these scripts seemingly legitimately for their condition and then just selling them to whoever because they don't want them, they don't need them, they don't care anymore or whatever it might be. That's a horrible situation.
Well, and the other piece of this, as we wrap up on time, is the fact that they were putting Seroquel or generic Seroquel or whatever means, were they diverting other things? Or did this wholesaler have a...
I'm confused, yeah.
Did they have a lot of Seroquel? Like, because in order to do that, they have to have it.
Yeah.
They have to have it. It's you know, it's an amazing thing. So I don't know. This is really just a terrible case. And wait, I want to give you kind of the last piece of this is, let's just go back to inventory reconciliation. And I think that generally speaking, inventory reconciliations are just math. How many pills did you buy? How many pills did you dispense? Right? That's not really the challenge. The challenge, I think, with inventory reconciliation is that, right, PBMs and investigators are only able to see the records for their business line, right? So there has to be an inherent understanding that any inventory reconciliation you do is going to have inherent limits to your ability to see the universe, right?
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it's just, I don't know that there's a workaround for that, really. If you only have access to, you know, the client you're working on, it's like the inventory reconciliation kind of goes out the window. I mean, I don't know what the answer to that is. How do you fix it?
You're limited. I mean, I always say if a PBM comes in and says to a pharmacy, show us the records that show the, you know, you claim you billed us for 100 amoxicillin. Get us the inventory records to show 100 amoxicillin. And they do. And PBM one says, okay, you billed us for 100, your inventory records show 100. Have a good day. Well, now a week later, PBM 2 comes in and says, hey, show us the inventory records. You billed us for 100 amoxicillin. Show us the inventory records for 100 amoxicillin. And that could be for the exact same time period or a very close time period to PBM 1. The pharmacy is going to go, here are your inventory records. And PBM 2 is going to say, okay, you're good, but you're really not good, right? And unfortunately, in this space, the PBMs don't have that purview to see that. They're only seeing that limited piece of the puzzle. It's a little bit like when you're looking at a case that involves an impossible day or some inordinate number of claims in a particular day. For the most part, the payer only sees the claims for that one. I think what makes us a little bit unique, Matt, is we have a concentration of plans that are in the same geographic area. And so we know that those providers that are billing one plan are billing multiple plans because it's the same geographical area. So we have the ability to take a look at the data from one plan and then take a look at the data from another and maybe open up multiple cases because the provider's doing the same thing. That's unique. PBMs don't necessarily have the ability to do that. So for people that do these kinds of investigations, you have to take inventory reconciliations with a little bit of a grain of salt because you don't know if it's 100% accurate. But if anybody has, you know, time, look this press release up. It is one of the worst. It's one of the best cases I've seen in a long time. So I think it was great. The OIG office was able to work this. They worked it with their partners at the FBI. So this was an amazing case that was worked. The patient harm factor is just really unbelievable when you look at it. So take a read of it. This is a really long press release. And the fact that they've got these photographs just makes your jaw drop as to what the heck was going on. So good stuff. This was, you know, this one was a heartbreaker because the fact that they even had a witness who took the wrong drug and suffered really severe, luckily didn't die, but obviously suffered some severe health consequences by going unconscious for a day because they probably took, you know, if they're supposed to take 3 HIV pills and they took 3 Seroquel, and Seroquel is a one pill and they took 3, like you could clearly see what could have happened there. So crazy case. But just shows that kind of diversity of healthcare fraud investigations and where they can go. So as always, Matt, Wade, good seeing you guys. Good interacting with you. Next week, maybe I'll polish this down a little bit less. See what I get.
No, for the three holes where you put your thumb in the middle thing.
Yeah, no need for the extra commentary, but thanks, Matt. I appreciate that.
Put it in the bowling ball polisher? Is it?
Yeah, well, what I do is I have Jean Marie hold me upside down, like for the shoes, you know, the thing for shoes. So yeah. She holds me upside down and then she back and forth the black side, because that's the one that's coarser.
Nice.
And then and then we go over to the red for the finish. So I appreciate it. So again, I really would say that I enjoyed speaking with both of you this week, but as always, I like speaking with you. So good stuff. So as always, thanks for tuning into this week newsletter every Friday. We're bringing back twice a week. We're bringing back yoga breaks. We took a little bit of a break. You'll see that on LinkedIn. You'll be able to sign up for that. Again, it's on Teams. I think Tuesday, Thursdays are going to be our yoga break, 11 to 11:15. So we're bringing that back after a little bit of a break. We have a great yoga instructor here that's joined us, and he will be taking the lead. That's Daryl, one of our investigators. We just did a profile on him last week, I believe, for our Welcome to Advise. So you can catch that. We've got a bunch of LinkedIn Lives coming up. You can catch, you can take a look at LinkedIn Lives, see those. And as always, our newsletter and our weekly podcast. So keep joining. We appreciate everybody spending their time, and we'll see you all in the next OIG roundtable. Take care.
Thank you all.
Thank you.